too much for Freddie Jr. to tolerate. As Donald watched the tragedy unfold, he stepped up and became his father's protege in his building empire. I can only imagine that following a brother who drank himself to death didn't leave Donald much room to do anything but try and fill the void where his older brother had failed. Obviously, he was successful at this endeavor in his father's world of real estate, and the two spent many years working together until Donald moved on to captain his own company. Fred Trump could never understand why Donald wanted to take the financial risk of building in Manhattan. The elder Trump felt that the ease they enjoyed being successful in Brooklyn and Queens should have been intoxicating enough for his son. However, Donald appeared to be attracted to the bright lights of the big city and the challenge of being more successful than his father. From the same New York Times article, Trump's childhood friends have said they see in him his father's intensity, but also a constant and often palpable need to please and impress the patriarch who ruled his family with a firm hand. Even today, Donald Trump seems to bathe in his father's approval. A framed photo of Fred Trump faces him on his cluttered desk. Donald said he learned his father's values and his killer sense of competition by following him to building sites and watching him squeeze the most out of every dollar. In a speech to the National Association of Home Builders, Trump said, "My father would go and pick up the extra nails and scraps, and he'd use whatever he could and recycle it in some form or sell it." According to an article in The Guardian, Dean, 2016, when Fred Trump died in 1999, Donald Trump gave a cheerful quote for his father's New York Times obituary, focusing on the way his dad had never wanted to expand into Manhattan. "It was good for me," he said. "You know, being the son of somebody, it could have been competition to me. This way, I got Manhattan all to myself." At his father's wake, Donald stepped forward to address family, friends, and the society power brokers in the crowd. One attendee recalled Mr. Trump's unorthodox eulogy to his father. "My father taught me everything I know, and he would understand what I'm about to say," Mr. Trump announced to the room. "I'm developing a great building on Riverside Boulevard called Trump Place. It's a wonderful project." Not the warmest send-off, but it highlighted the language and sentiment that the two men shared. It was the point of their connection. When Donald's father, Fred Trump, was 15, he started in the building business alongside his mother due to the fact that his father died just 3 years earlier. At the age of 53, Donald, with the death of his own father, was wasting no time on tears. He was moving forward in the familial quest for financial success. Donald witnessed his father's tough negotiating style, even at home. One time, some of Donald's friends were confused as to why his wealthy father would not buy him a new baseball glove. Trump said it was because his father suspected him, correctly, of playing dumb about the high price of the glove he wanted and of trying to get the salesman to go along with this ruse. It appears Donald learned early on that his father's frugality would leave him wanting. It also may have taught him that he needed to be sneaky at times to get what he desired. "When I was about the same age, I remember my father telling me how surprised and impressed he was that I was able to convince a salesman to refund our money and take back an expensive board game that we had already opened but didn't like. I could see in my father's face that he was enamored of my moxie." The power of a father's attention to our behavior forms a strong lock and key for that behavior to become something we depend upon in order, hopefully, to receive that same coveted attention again and again. Of course, I've learned the hard way that behaviors I picked up from pleasing my father don't always translate to the healthiest way to relate to others. Those habits take time and experience to break. Fred Trump's housing projects made him wealthy and powerful. Some tenants appreciated him for his solid, well-priced apartments. Others loathed him for his suspected exclusion of blacks from his properties. The famous folk singer Woody Guthrie, who wrote This Land Is Your Land, was a tenant of Mr. Trump's Beach Haven Apartments for 2 years. In the early 1950s, he composed two songs that address his disgust with the racist practices of Fred Trump that he witnessed. Here are some of his lyrics from the songs he wrote. I suppose old man Trump knows just how much racial hate he stirred up in the blood pot of human hearts when he drawed that color line here at his 1800 family project. Beach Haven looks like heaven where no black ones come to roam. No, 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 old man Trump. Old Beach Haven ain't my home. Unlike Trump, I was fortunate to watch my father come home daily from saving lives as a physician. I can only imagine how ashamed I would have felt if my father had been accused of being racist by anyone, much less a famous composer. That being said, Donald may not have given it a second thought. The human brain can protect us from seeing and feeling what it believes may be too uncomfortable for us to tolerate. It can lead us to deny, defend, minimize, or rationalize away something that doesn't fit our worldview. Actually, as I observe President Trump's behavior, I imagine that there is a good chance he identifies with his father's aggressive business style and parenting, and is now employing that orientation to his role as president. In psychology, this is called identification with the aggressor. At first, it may appear counterintuitive to identify with an aggressor who has abused his position of power to take advantage. However, our brains often use this early relationship as a template to shape our future behavior. We are attracted to the power we witness from our powerless position. We can be hungry for the same power that we originally resented or even fought against. Taking all this into consideration, President Trump's aggressive behavior seems to illuminate the part of his father that still lives on within him. Individuals with such a history often exhibit insecurities that can lead to all kinds of compensatory behaviors. However, no matter how successful a person is at alleviating the associated anxiety, fear usually still exists unconsciously and can be uncovered at times of stress. Trump's sensitivity to being seen as weak or vulnerable, along with his need to exaggerate and distort the truth, are signs of his deep-seated insecurity. His confabulation protects his fragile ego. Meanwhile, his blustering becomes fodder for comedians and the media. Watching reporters try to address the alternative facts and Trump's impulsive tweets with his press secretary's staff is comically surreal. In simplified fashion, in order for Trump to avoid feeling the effects of his insecurities and to feed his narcissistic needs, he appears to compensate by trying to be seen as powerful and special, with the hope that he will indeed feel powerful and special. Only he knows the truth about how successful he is at this. The human brain has a unique ability to work in the background, using past beliefs as if we were living in the times when those beliefs are birthed. From a survivalist standpoint, our brains work off the assumption that we are safer to believe that situations will most likely repeat themselves. We don't challenge those beliefs unless something drastic occurs that overwhelms our defenses. We have learned through research on trauma survivors that early events that stimulate our fight-or-flight response have long-lasting effects. It usually directs us to create a negative belief about ourselves, which in turn leads to the counterbalancing behaviors that try to minimize the deleterious effects of those negative beliefs. Therefore, President Trump will most likely change his way of being only if reality throws him a large enough curveball to which he is unable to respond using the signature defensive measures he has grown accustomed to. the beliefs and compensatory mechanisms that young Donald created to help steward him through the turbulent waters of his childhood are probably still in effect today. They were reinforced during his years working with his father, and later as a successful businessman. As the owner of his own company, he was able to exact control and demand loyalty in ways that he cannot as president. Transferring his strategies and expectations to the culture of government has been frustrating for him, and his responses to that frustration have been eye-opening. He doesn't appear to have the flexibility to switch gears in order to deal with the function of his job as president. His handling of FBI Director James Comey is a good example. Conversations about loyalty appear to have contributed to his firing. Trump's befuddlement regarding all the fireworks that ensued makes it appear that he is either limited in understanding the impact of his behavior or insensitive to it. Either way, his leadership leaves a large segment of the population feeling insecure and fearful about what to expect next. Fred Trump's competitiveness was quite apparent near the end of his life, when he was quoted as saying that his thrice-divorced son would never beat him in the marital department, since he had been married to the same woman for 60 years. In addition, when Donald Trump was asked in 2016 while he was running for office what his father would have said about him running for president, he said, "He would have absolutely allowed me to have done it." Allowed? Despite being 70 years old, Trump answered as if he were an adolescent in an Oedipal battle with his father, who had died 17 years earlier. In August of 2016, I was speaking with my father on the phone about the presidential election, and he was addressing his confusion as to why Trump was acting so erratically. This was at a time when there were several articles being written about how Trump's advisors were having difficulty getting him to stop tweeting his aggressive thoughts and feelings. I was surprised when my father asked me what my understanding as a psychiatrist was regarding Trump's behavior. Usually, my father has his own ideas about why things are the way they are, and enjoys teaching me what he feels the truth is. Although I had strong feelings and ideas about why Trump was acting the way he was, my father's inquiry felt like an easy path to receiving some of the attention and respect that I continue to look for. It felt powerful and invigorating to be asked by my father what my thoughts were. As I proceeded to describe my hypothesis of what was happening with Trump, I confidently and proudly told my father that I believed that Trump was unconsciously sabotaging his chances of winning the election because a part of him probably recognized he wasn't worthy and/or capable of being successful in that position. I went on to say that Trump appeared to be more comfortable complaining about and fighting against the system that he believed was conspiring against his bid to be elected. In response, my father said, "Well, whatever's going on, I wish he would just shut up, because if Hillary wins, it'll be horrible for Israel." Despite giving my father what I felt was my intellectual gold, he only commented on what was important to him. Since Trump has taken office, I have tried to engage my father and others within my family and in the Orthodox Jewish community about my concerns with Trump's exaggerations and lying, along with his xenophobia, all of which appear to be playing on the fears and insecurities of his support base. Almost invariably, I hear, "Yeah, he's a little crazy, but he'll be better than Obama ever was." Or something like, "Don't be such a bad sport. You guys lost. Deal with it." And when people were protesting peacefully around the country, I would hear, "When Obama won, we never acted this way." When I explained that it's a wonderful thing that we live in a place where we have the right to protest, my words usually fell on deaf ears. I couldn't believe that Trump's behavior was being downplayed. By questioning it, I was automatically labeled by some as having drunk the liberal Kool-Aid. Some inferred that I must believe that Israel wasn't without sin in its fight to live in peace with the Palestinians. Others accused me of wanting a socialist state. It became clear that, in parts of my family and within the wider community of Orthodox Jews, there was an us versus them mentality. It's frustrating to be told that my thoughts and clinical ideas about unfolding events are really just politically motivated. It is especially difficult for me to be thrown into a category where family and friends wrongly assume that I must not care about Israel enough, or that I am more sympathetic to the plight of Syrian refugees than to the safety of Israelis and Americans. I try to explain that my love for Israel is separate from my feelings for anybody who is being trampled on by Trump's process. No lives should be dismissed as unimportant. All this feels surreal as I try to emphasize that any end, even Israel's security, that follows an inappropriate process is dangerously fragile and not worth depending on. The online environment of Facebook has taken center stage as the arena of choice for many Jews to fight about politics in general and about Trump specifically. I had a friend on Facebook say that in continuing to attack Trump's behavior, I was forgetting the Holocaust. I was told that Trump's policies were protecting Americans by keeping dangerous people outside our borders. The fact that innocent people were being harmed, they said, was an unfortunate but necessary side effect. Conversely, a few Jewish patients I treat who are children of Holocaust survivors fear that another Holocaust is more likely because of Trump's policies and his association with the likes of Steve Bannon. They are afraid that those in bed with white nationalists send a message to anti-Semitic people that it is safe to act out their racist and prejudiced agendas. I recently spent the Jewish holiday of Passover with my family at a resort where a conservative political writer had been hired to speak. My family and I attended the talk, which I assumed would be pro-Trump. I sat with my father while the speaker made clear that he was not happy with Trump, and furthermore, he felt that Trump's leadership style was dangerous. I almost laughed out loud as I watched my father's mouth drop open. During the question and answer session, I asked about the impact on Orthodox Jews voting for a man who has such a flawed process of leading, yet who supports the State of Israel. The speaker validated my concerns by responding that the ends do not justify the means, stating emphatically, "President Trump needs to shut up and just let those he has selected for his cabinet do their jobs and push their conservative agenda forward." Afterward, my father minimized what he had heard, as if acknowledging the speaker's full message would leave him too vulnerable. In the end, I felt as if I had won a battle. Perhaps more importantly, this situation illustrates the dance my father and I often fall into when we unknowingly work out where we stand in relationship to each other. My father and I, like Donald and his father, are men with unique flavors of insecurity. Unwittingly, we use each other to make a case for the verdict we already believe about ourselves. Donald and I are expert at putting our fathers on pedestals, while at the same time trying to knock them off in order to make room for us to have our time being seen as special. A part of us believes this will lead to feeling special, but it's fleeting. It only lasts long enough to make us keep wishing for it again and again. Unfortunately, since it's a cover for our true negative beliefs about ourselves, we often sabotage and cut short our stay on this shaky pedestal. It's a precarious perch for us, a lonely view from a place we actually don't feel we fully deserve. On the night that Donald Trump won the election, he couldn't be found for a number of hours for comment on his momentous victory. In Leslie Stahl's 60 Minutes interview aired 3 days later, he was asked where he had been during those hours. he soberly responded, "I realized this is a whole different life for me." It was as if the president-elect had never imagined actually winning. He seemed stunned that he had knocked out his formidable opponent and now would be expected to put his angry father persona on the shelf and go to work as the next president. Is that what he really wanted? One wonders if he even had a victory speech prepared at all. As with all adults, Donald Trump's early development created who we are witnessing. Children need to receive love and attention in order to feel secure, but they receive only the love and attention that their parents are capable of providing. Indeed, his father's intensity left its mark on the entire family. Donald's oldest brother essentially killed himself under his father's rule. This tragedy must have played a prominent role in the formation of Donald's identity and left minimal room to rebel against his father's authority, except through competition in the realm of business success. Despite their appreciation for each other, the tension between father and son caused Donald psychological wounds that still fester. To compensate, Donald Trump puffs himself up to project a macho image that appeals to many of his followers. But it's empty, a defense against his fear of seeming weak and ineffectual like his brother. Before being elected, Trump could treat people as he wished, using his wealth and status as a means to achieve his goals. As the President of the United States, he is expected to handle issues more delicately and follow the checks and balances that make up our democratic society. Unfortunately for him, and possibly the nation, his strengths that got him elected president don't ensure success in that position. Trump's base of support saw in him the strength to be powerful in ways they didn't see in themselves and/or in past leadership. What they may not be aware of is that President Trump appears to question his own ability to deliver what they are seeking. Evidence of this can be seen in his use of lying, distortion, marginalization, and the firing of those he fears are disloyal. Our fathers did the best they could with the resources they had, and our unique connection with them helps fill the gaps where we feel deficient. Despite the moments of contention, and maybe even because of them, I feel fortunate to have a relationship with a father who continues to do his part to help our relationship become closer. I'm also grateful for the insight I've received through psychotherapy to address those parts of myself that are either stuck or confused by my past. It's unfortunate that our president has not figured out how to heal himself, or at least learn how to do his job without being defensive and aggressive with those that disagree with him. I feel for the young parts of the president that are trying desperately to help him swim through rough waters, despite fear of drowning. What most concerns me is whether we Americans can tread water long enough to come together and avoid being pulled under.
Steve Rubel, M.D., is an accomplished singer-songwriter and storyteller. He has won the Moth Story Slam, for which he uses a pseudonym in slam competitions. Dr. Rubel is also a board-certified child and adult psychiatrist in private practice in Manhattan and Ridgewood, New Jersey, at the Venn Center. He specializes in anxiety disorders, trauma, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. He attended medical school in his hometown of Memphis, Tennessee, and did his general psychiatry residency at Northwestern University. He did his child psychiatry fellowship at the Institute for Juvenile Research at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he was chief fellow.
Trump and the American Collective Psyche by Thomas Singer, M.D. While I join with those who believe that we need to question Donald Trump's psychological fitness to be president, my focus is less on individual psychopathology than on the interface between Trump and the American collective psyche. There are ways in which Trump mirrors, even amplifies, our collective attention deficit disorder, our sociopathy, and our narcissism. Therefore, this is less about diagnosing a public figure than about recognizing our own pathology. Trump has mesmerized our national psyche like no other public figure in recent memory. There is no doubt that his appeal, his wealth, power, celebrity status, and his brash willingness to shoot from the hip resonates powerfully with the collective psyche of many Americans, while these same qualities are repulsive to many others. The more vulgar, bullying, impulsive, and self-congratulatory Trump's behavior and rhetoric, the more some people worship him, while others fervently denounce him as a grave danger to our republic. To probe the profound collective disturbance that Trump activates and symbolizes, I draw on my experience as a psychiatrist and a Jungian psychoanalyst. A psychological theory about Trump's appeal, a marriage of the shadow, archetypal defenses, and the self at the group level of the psyche to form a cultural complex. You don't need to be a psychologist or psychiatrist to see that Donald Trump has a problem of narcissism. Ted Cruz announced on May 3, 2016, the day of the Indiana Republican presidential primary, that Trump was, quote, a pathological liar, utterly amoral, a narcissist at a level I don't think this country's ever seen, and a serial philanderer, end quote. In a series of papers and books written over the past decade, I have developed a working model of the theory of cultural complexes that may be useful for understanding Trumpism. I will be talking about the psyche of the group, what lives inside each of us as individual carriers of the group psyche, and what lives between us in our shared group psyche. The group psyche engages with themes and conflicts that are not the same as our more personal psychological struggles. I hypothesize a direct link between Trump's personal narcissism and the collective psyche of those American citizens who embrace his perception of America and who feel that he understands and speaks to them. This is not a political analysis. It is a psychological analysis of what we can think of as the group psyche, which contributes enormously to and fuels political processes. This analysis is based on the notion that there are certain psychological energies, even structures, at the level of the cultural or group psyche that are activated at times of heightened threats to the core identity of the group, what we might think of as the group self. Three of these most important energies structures are 1, the shadow, 2, archetypal defenses of the group self, and 3, the group self itself. These energy structures take shape around social, political, economic, geographic, and religious themes that are alive in specific contexts and with particular contents. This same type of analysis may currently apply in the Brexit crisis in Great Britain or in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, with very different contexts and contents in which various groups can be seen as protecting their threatened or wounded self from being further injured by pursuing a defensive, aggressive attack against imagined or real dangerous enemies. What is it about Trump that acts as an irresistible magnet with ferocious attraction or repulsion? Is Trump the end product of our culture of narcissism? Is he what we get and deserve because he epitomizes the god or gods we currently worship in our mindless, consumerist, hyper-indulged cult of continuous stimulation and entertainment? Here is how Christopher Hedges states it in Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. Quote, an image-based culture communicates through narratives, pictures, and pseudo-drama. Scandalous affairs, hurricanes, untimely deaths, train wrecks, These events play well on computer screens and television. International diplomacy, labor union negotiations, and convoluted bailout packages do not yield exciting personal narratives or stimulating images. Reality is complicated. Reality is boring. We are incapable or unwilling to handle its confusion. We become trapped in the linguistic prison of incessant repetition. We are fed words and phrases like war on terror, or pro-life, or change. And within these narrow parameters, all complex thought, ambiguity, and self-criticism vanish. End quote. In addition to our collective inability to sort out illusion from reality, our culture gets further hopelessly entangled with our cult of celebrity. Hedges does not spare us the dire consequences of our intoxication with celebrity, which both fuels the split between illusion and reality while simultaneously filling the gap between the two. Quote, celebrity culture plunges us into a moral void. No one has any worth beyond his or her appearance, usefulness, or ability to succeed. The highest achievements in a celebrity culture are wealth, sexual conquest, and fame. It does not matter how these are obtained. We have a right in the cult of the self to get whatever we desire. We can do anything, even belittle and destroy those around us, including our friends, to make money, to be happy, and to become famous. Once fame and wealth are achieved, they become their own justification, their own morality. End quote. It seems clear that Trump's narcissism and his attacks on political correctness dovetail with deep needs in a significant portion of the American population to enhance their dwindling sense of place in America and of America's place in the world. Trump's narcissism can be seen as a perfect compensatory mirror for the narcissistic needs and injuries of those who support him. Or stated another way, there is a good fit. With this general formulation in mind, I analyze how Trump's presidency speaks to three highly intertwined parts of the American group psyche. One, a woundedness at the core of the American group self. Two, the defenses mobilized in the groups that feel wounded, who wish to protect against further injury to the shared group self, and three, the promise or hope of a cure for the wound. One, a wound to the American group self. There is a wound at the core of the American group self spirit that is deeply felt by many, especially by those who have not participated in our nation's prosperity, and by others who are relatively well off but are keenly aware that our system of government and our way of life are threatened at the core of our collective being. Here is a working definition of the group self or spirit that I put forth in an earlier paper. Quote, the group spirit is the ineffable core beliefs or sense of identity that binds people together, that is known to its members through a sense of belonging, shared essential beliefs, core historical experiences of loss and revelation, deepest yearnings and ideals. One can begin to circle around the nature of a group spirit by asking questions such as, what is most sacred to the group? What binds the group's members together? End quote. Many in our country, on the left, right, and in the center, feel that this stage in our history is less secure than earlier stages. This nervousness about our essential well-being is deeply felt by the progressive left, by the conservative right, and by all those who feel alienated and angered by the current leaders of all branches of government, whom they see as destroying the country, whether the archenemy be Donald Trump of the Republicans or Hillary Clinton of the Democrats. On the right, the threat of terrorism, Muslims, immigrants, Mexicans, the global economy, China and international trade agreements, or progressives, are seen as leading us to the brink. On the left, the threats to a sense of well-being and security in our national group self come as the result of the growing disparity in the distribution of wealth and income, the mistreatment of vulnerable minorities of different races, colors, ethnicities, sexual identities, or genders, our power relationships to other countries around the world, and of course, the maltreatment of the environment. I postulate that these threats are amplified on all sides by an even deeper, less conscious threat that I call extinction anxiety. Extinction anxiety exists both in the personal and group psyche and is based on the fear of the loss of supremacy by white Americans of the United States, the loss of America's place in the world as we have known it, and ultimately the destruction of the environment and the world itself. One might think of extinction anxiety as the cultural psyche's equivalent of death anxiety in the individual. For instance, climate change deniers on the right may be seen as denying the very real possibility of the planet's destruction as a way of defending themselves against the fear of extinction. Aligning himself with this attitude, Trump offers to dispel extinction anxiety by denying it is real and appointing a well-known climate change denier as the head of the EPA. Denial, whether at the individual or group level, is the most primitive defense the mind employs to protect itself from psychic pain. Here is how Joseph Epstein has described the injury to the group self spirit of those attracted to Trump. Quote, "Something deeper, I believe, is rumbling behind the astounding support for Mr. Trump, a man who, apart from his large but less than pure business success, appears otherwise entirely without qualification for the presidency. I had a hint of what might be behind the support for him a few weeks ago when, on one of the major network news shows, I watched a reporter ask a woman at a Trump rally why she was supporting him. A thoroughly respectable-seeming middle-class woman, she replied without hesitation, 'I want my country back.' I don't believe that this woman is a racist or that she yearns for immigrants, gays, and other minorities to be suppressed, or even that she truly expects to turn back the clock on social change in the U.S. What she wants is precisely what she says, her country back. She couldn't any longer bear to watch the United States on the descent, hostage to progressivist ideas that bring neither contentment nor satisfaction, but instead foster a state of perpetual protest and agitation, anger and tumult. So great is the frustration of Americans who do not believe in these progressivist ideas, who see them as ultimately tearing the country apart, that they are ready to turn, in their near hopelessness, to a man of Donald Trump's patently low quality." End quote. The self or group spirit of America is built on more than 300 years of progress, success, achievement, resourcefulness, and ingenuity, accompanied by almost endless opportunity and good fortune. We love and believe in our heroic potential, our freedom and independence, our worship of height and speed, youth, newness, technology, our optimism, and eternal innocence. We have enjoyed the profound resilience of the American spirit, which has shown itself repeatedly through very difficult historical trials, including our Civil War, World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, the Vietnam War, the 9/11 attacks, the Iraq War, the financial collapse in 2008, and other major crises, including the one we may be in now. As a country, we have been blessed in our capacity to transcend loss, failure, and the threat of defeat in the face of crisis time and time again. And this has contributed to a positive vision of ourselves that has been fundamentally solid at the core for a long time. Of course, that self-image is subject to inflation, arrogance, and a morphing into hubris in which we believe in our own exceptionalism and are blind to our causing grave injury to peoples at home and abroad. It is quite possible that Trump's personal inflation, arrogance, and hubris represent a compensatory antidote in our group psyche that is beginning to suffer severe self-doubt about our ability to navigate a highly uncertain future, the nostalgic longing of which is perfectly articulated in the phrase, "I want my country back." 2. Archetypal defenses of the group self. A significant number of people in our society feel cut off from what they believe to be their inherited, natural birthright as American citizens. Although they would not use this language, they are suffering a wound and threat at the level of the group self, even as they are also suffering individually. We can think of this as a narcissistic injury at the group level. I suggest that Trump has somehow intuited that injury and is playing to it, both as a self-proclaimed carrier of the group renewal and as a defender against those who would do further harm to it, be they terrorists, immigrants, Washington political insiders, the established Republican Party, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, James Comey, or anyone else who gets in Trump's way. Trump's embrace of the shadow of political correctness. Trump's particular political genius in the 2016 presidential election cycle was to launch his campaign with an attack on political correctness. With incredible manipulative skill, Trump's call to arms, "Get him out of here," made its first appearance at his rallies when he urged the faithful in his crowds to get rid of protesters. "Get him out of here" also seems to be his pledge to rid the country of Mexicans, Muslims, and other groups that are being portrayed as dangerous threats to the American way of life. Trump's strategy has been shrewd. He sensed that political correctness could be the trigger word and target for unleashing potent levels of shadow energies that have been accumulated in the cultural unconscious of the group psyche. He rode a huge wave of pent-up resentment, racism, and hatred long enough to crush all opponents and become the President of the United States. The notion of a trigger word activating a complex goes back to Jung's early word association tests, in which certain words detonated powerful emotions contained within personal complexes, such as the mother or father complex. Skillful politicians can trigger cultural or group complexes by a collective word association process that then takes on a life of its own. Trump is at his best when he is at his most awful. His willingness to be politically incorrect became a sign, to many, of his truth-telling. Amid a most dangerous battle between the alternative facts of the alt-right and fake news of the left, came an outpouring of the paranoia and hostility embedded in the cultural complex of those who loathe the deep state. Collective emotion is the only truth that matters. A group caught up in a cultural complex has highly selective memory, if any historical memory at all, and chooses only those historical and contemporary facts that validate their pre-existing opinion. Evidence of this is that no matter what Trump does or how many lies he tells, his base remains steadfast in its support of him, as the polls tell us. This kind of shadow energy is available for exploitation if a group that previously saw itself as having a solid place in American society, such as white middle-class Americans in the Rust Belt or coal miners in West Virginia, finds itself marginalized and drifting downward both socially and economically. How easy it is for such a group to see recent immigrants to this country as stealing the American dream from them. Here is how George Orwell, in his novel 1984, imagined the exploitation of those most subject to intoxication with an authoritarian leader like Trump. Quote, "In a way, the worldview of the party imposed itself most successfully on people incapable of understanding it. They could be made to accept the most flagrant violations of reality because they never fully grasped the enormity of what was demanded of them. They simply swallowed everything." End quote. Donald Trump uncovered a huge sinkhole of dark, raw emotions in the national psyche for all of us to see. Rage, hatred, envy, and fear surfaced in a forgotten, despairing, growing white underclass who had little reason to believe that the future would hold the promise of a brighter, life-affirming purpose. Trump tapped into the negative feelings that many Americans have about all the things we are supposed to be compassionate about: ethnic, racial, gender, and religious differences. What a relief, so many must have thought, to hear a politician speak their unspoken resentments and express their rage. Trump tapped into the dirty little secret of their loathing of various minorities, even though we may all be minorities now. Trump's formula for repairing these deep wounds had him chanting around the country the hopeful mantra of making better deals. Once the complex takes over the narrative, or the narrative gives voice to the complex's core, facts simply become irrelevant. Inevitably, this leads to the kind of terrifying 1984 scenario in which, quote, the Ministry of Peace concerns itself with war, the Ministry of Truth with lies, the Ministry of Love with torture, and the Ministry of Plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental, nor do they result from ordinary hypocrisy. They are deliberate exercises in doublethink. If human equality is to be forever averted, if the high, as we have called them, are to keep their places permanently, then the prevailing mental condition must be controlled insanity. Trump's cabinet appointments strongly suggest that this is what is happening in our country. The job of each new cabinet leader is to reverse or dismantle the very reason for which his or her department exists. Unholy marriage of shadow, archetypal defenses of the group self, and the group self. What makes Trump's unleashing of the shadow in the American psyche even more dangerous is that these energies become linked or even identical with what I call archetypal defenses of the group spirit. Quote, when this part of the collective psyche is activated, the most primitive psychological forces come alive for the purpose of defending the group and its collective spirit or self. I capitalize self because I want to make it clear that it is not just the persona or ego identity of the group that is under attack, but something at an even deeper level of the collective psyche, which one might think of as the spiritual home or God of the group. The tribal spirit of the clan or of the nation often lies dormant or in the background, but when it is threatened, the defenses mobilized to protect it are ferocious and impersonal. The mobilization of such potent, archaic defenses is fueled by raw collective emotion and rather simplistic, formulaic ideas and/or beliefs that dictate how the group will think, feel, react, and behave. End quote. These activated archetypal defenses of the group spirit find concrete expression in forms as varied as the unrest of divided populations over the legal status of foreign immigrants in countries around the world, the threatened development of nuclear weapons by nation-states such as Iran or North Korea, the deployment of suicide bombers by terrorist groups, or the launching of massive military expeditions by world powers. And these same kinds of archetypal defenses come alive in all sorts of skirmishes between diverse groups of people who perceive their most sacred values in jeopardy. The LGBTQ community, blacks, Latinos, white men, women, the Christian right in the United States, Jews around the world, the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the Middle East. The list of groups threatened at the core of their being or at the level of the group self seems endless. What makes Trump's narcissism so dangerous in its mix of shadow, his attacks on all sorts of groups of people, and self elements, his self-aggrandizing, inflated sense of himself and those for whom he pretends to speak, is that it plays to the unholy marriage of self and the aggressive, hateful, and violent elements in the collective psyche. Trump's example gives permission for shadowy thoughts, feelings, and actions on behalf of the self. This underlying group dynamic explains the comparison of Trump to Hitler. Evoking an archaic image of the German self, Hitler mobilized the most shadowy forces in modern history in the so-called service of that self-image, which centered on the supremacy of the Aryan race. First the brown shirts, then the Gestapo, SS, and other forces of the Third Reich, including its highly efficient bureaucracy. Trump seems to be toying with the collective shadow, encouraging its acting out in the name of the self. It is hard to imagine Trump leading the United States in the same direction that Hitler led Germany. I certainly hope I don't live to regret writing these words. But the dynamic is still terrifying. From a Jungian perspective, when the shadowy defenses of the group spirit and the group self closely align, there is great danger of violence, tyranny, and absolutism, especially with an authoritarian leader and a citizenry responsive to authoritarianism. 3. Curing the wounded self of America. Trump's selfie and America's selfie. The third and final component of this intertwined triad of forces in the group psyche is Trump's implicit promise of providing a cure for the wound at the level of the group self. This is where his narcissism is most prominent and most dangerous. The unconscious equation can be stated as follows. Quote, I am the greatness to which America may once again aspire. By identifying with how great I am, you can rekindle your wounded American dream and make yourself and America great again, unquote. Or even more bluntly, quote, I have achieved the American dream. I am the American dream. I am the incarnation of the self that the country aspires to, end quote. This is, of course, a massive inflation. Trump's identification of his personal being with the self of America is his source of demagogic appeal. He is encouraging those who have lost a foothold in the American dream to place their trust in him as a mirror of their own potential, a potential that he has already achieved. Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, characterizes his magnetic appeal. Quote, I play to people's fantasies. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those who do. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. People want to believe that something is the biggest and the greatest and the most spectacular. I call it truthful hyperbole. End quote. Trump has managed to cultivate and catch the projection of a powerful and successful person who, by virtue of his alleged business acumen and ability to negotiate, is able to make things happen for his own betterment, though rarely for the betterment of others, despite his false claims of giving generously to charities and creating untold jobs. You too can be like me, aggressive, successful, big, powerful, he is saying. This is the narcissism of Trump joining with the injured narcissism of those Americans who have seen their chances for well-being and security rapidly slip away. Trump celebrates the materialistic, power version of the American dream, of the big man who has made himself rich and powerful through the strength of his personality. He is free to speak his own mind and to pursue without limits his own self-aggrandizing goals that he equates with those of America. The negative aspects of Trump's narcissism strike those who are repelled by him, both at home and abroad, as a symbolic mirror of everything negative about a culture of narcissism. For many, he's become the very embodiment of everything bad about America. A self-promoting brand, an arrogant bully bursting with hubris, gross insensitivities to others' needs, possession by consumerism and greed, and entitlement and good fortune, which we have come to believe is our natural due. These are core characteristics of an American cultural complex that betrays that best self or spirit on which the nation and its constitution were founded. Trump's narcissism is a perfect mirror of our national and even personal narcissism. Ultimately, I believe that the Trump phenomena is less about Trump than about us, about who we are as a people. The elephant in the room turns out to be we, the people of the United States. How terrifying to think that our politics and our lives today have gotten horribly confused with reality TV, social media, computer and cell phone technology, and their infinite capacity to turn reality into illusion, self into narcissism. Conclusion: groping the American psyche and psychic contagion. There are so many potentially destructive consequences of the emerging Trump presidency on the climate, on minorities, on immigrants, on women's rights, on the integrity of the Constitution, and on our relationships with China, Russia, Syria, Iran, North Korea, and even our own allies. But one of the most disturbing thoughts about the Trump presidency is that he has taken up residence not just in the White House, but in the psyches of each and every one of us. We are going to have to live with him rattling around inside of us, all of us at the mercy of his impulsive and bullying whims as he lashes out at whatever gets under his skin in the moment with uninformed, inflammatory barbs. The way a president lives inside each of us can feel like a very personal and intimate affair. Those who identify with Trump and love the way he needles the elites, whom they fear, envy, and despise, may relish the fact that he lives inside of us as a tormentor. Trump is well-versed in brutally toying with his enemies, who include women, professionals, the media, the educated classes, and minorities, to mention just a few. What most frightens me about Trump is his masterful skill at invading and groping the national psyche. Many tired of the Clintons taking up permanent residence in our national psyche. Trump will soon put the Clintons to shame in his capacity to dwell in and stink up our collective inner space like the proverbial house guest who overstays his welcome. And many of us never invited Trump into our psychic houses in the first place. That is perhaps why the image that has stayed with me the most from the national disgrace that was our election process in 2016 is that of the woman who came forward to tell her story of allegedly being sexually harassed by Trump. Some years ago, she was given an upgrade to first class on a plane and found herself sitting next to the Donald. In no time at all, she says, he was literally groping her all over, breasts and below. She describes the physicality of the assault as akin to being entangled in the tentacles of an octopus, and she was barely able to free herself and retreat to economy class. It now feels as though we have all been groped by the tentacles of Trump's octopus-like psyche, which has invaded our own and threatens to tighten its squeeze for several years. To put it as vulgarly as Trump himself might, Trump has grabbed the American psyche by the pussy. As we slowly collect ourselves after the devastating and unexpected tsunami of Trump winning the presidency and the roller coaster ride of his early days as president, many are finding renewed energy and commitment to challenge his shadowy agenda in new and creative ways. I hope that in a deep resurgence of activism to reclaim our most cherished and threatened American values, we will resist our tendency to cocoon ourselves in a self-righteous, arrogant bubble of narcissistic ideals, even in the name of being progressive.
Thomas Singer, M.D., is a psychiatrist and Jungian psychoanalyst practicing in San Francisco. In addition to private practice, he has served on Social Security's Hearing and Appeals Mental Impairment Disability Team. His interests include studying the relationships among myth, politics, and psyche in The Vision Thing and the Ancient Greece Modern Psyche series. He is the editor of a series of books exploring cultural complexes, including Placing Psyche, Listening to Latin America, Europe's Many Souls, The Cultural Complex, and a book in preparation on Asia. He is the current president of National Aris, an archive of symbolic imagery that has created the Book of Symbols.
Who Goes Trump? Tyranny as a Triumph of Narcissism by Elizabeth Micah. Tyrannies are three-legged beasts. They encroach upon our world in a steady creep, more often